Mr. Ferguson is in the business of selling used books. That's the man right back in that corner. He lives in Passaic, New Jersey. Now, I have a strong feeling that most of the books that are any good were printed before 1900. And one of them is a book by Paley, P-A-L-E-Y. His Horae Pauline, which means the times of Paul, is an excellent treatise on the authenticity of the New Testament. Now, Paley's works are usually bound in one volume. And if any of you want to get a good book, you get Mr. Ferguson to search a book called Paley's Works, and you will be well rewarded. Of course, he adds a suitable markup for his efforts, but it's well worth it. Now, here's what Paley has to say. There is satisfactory evidence that many professing to be the original witnesses of the Christian miracles passed their lives in labors, dangers, and sufferings voluntarily undergone in attestation of the accounts which they deliver, and solely in consequence of their belief of those accounts. And they also submitted from the same motives to new rules of conduct. This is a proposition which Paley undertakes to expound over many pages. Also, speaking of books, I don't see it over here. I don't think I do anyway, but there is a book available from the Christadelphian office, which, next to the Bible, I think has had more effect on my life than any other, and that is a book called Who Moved the Stone by a man named Frank Morrison. Now, this is a wonderful book dealing with the resurrection of Jesus. Marvelous! And if any of you are looking for Christmas presents, never mind boxes of candy and all that stuff, get this book to give it to somebody, and it'll be well worth it. You know, on the Christadelphia magazine, on the back inside cover, there's a list of books. Well, most of them are pretty good. And our ecclesial library in Hamilton, I think, has all of them, at least one copy. But this one is Who Moved the Stone? And it's by a man named Frank Morrison. He isn't a Christadelphian.
Morrison.
M-O-1-R, I think it is, I-S-O-N. Frank Morrison. A marvelous book. Dealing with the evidence of the resurrection of Jesus, and much of the material that I have given you is covered much more fully by Frank Morrison than I've been able to do it here. And Paley also devotes a great deal of work to this fact. And Paley flourished about 1790, I think it was.
What was the name of Paley's book?
Just Paley's Works. Paley's Complete Works is the best way to buy it. P-A-L-E-Y. I don't know his initials, but no doubt Mr. Ferguson could have it. It's fairly common. It'll probably cost you about, I don't know, up to maybe $7, depending on the quality of the book you happen to be able to get. Now, as we said yesterday, the whole warp and weft of the what we believe is on the focal point of the resurrection of Jesus. My brother is an atheist, and once in a while he lets me talk to him, not too often because he gets kind of annoyed, but I'll start telling him about the sign of the nation of Israel being restored, and he says, I don't think Jesus ever rose from the dead. So what are you telling me about the second coming for and so on? I don't even think the man ever rose from the dead, so there's no use talking about it. And that's it. Well, he's right. If Jesus rose from the dead and didn't rise from the dead, we're of all men most miserable, aren't we? So the people like him who read the New Testament and see that Christianity is here have to have some explanation for how it got here. You just can't have a man preach for 3 years and a half or so and affect the whole course of history, you know, just like that. I have all kinds of preachers, but not too many of them have affected the course of history. So somehow or other, they have to explain why it was that these disciples went forth with such a burning zeal to preach the resurrection of a man who still was in the grave. So one of the explanations they give is that these people suffered from an hallucination. They thought he came and showed them the nail prints, but they were suffering from an hallucination. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, but let's just look at this for a minute. First of all, have any of you ever had a dream so vivid that it is called a nightmare? That have any of you ever had what's known as a nightmare, a real honest to goodness nightmare, a vivid dream that when you woke up you were either scared or very moved by it, as opposed to dreams which most of us have every night. Have you ever had that? Did you have any difficulty finding out whether it was real or not? Maybe you were on a boat or something, and you were on a tall building, and you were looking all ready to go over. And when you woke up, did you have any difficulty realizing that it really was a nightmare and not real?
There's a time there where you can't quite distinguish it when you wake up.
That's right.
It takes a little period
for a while. For a while, I had a great aunt, Sister Perrine, her name was, who about once a week in the latter part of her life had nightmares of a spider, a great spider about that big around on the ceiling, coming down on her head like this. The thing would be on a, what do they call it, a spinneret, the rope, and down it would come, and it would just be like this, ready to go on her face, and she'd scream and yell. My aunt would have to rush in and wake her up, and it would took her about 10 minutes to get organized, you know, that there really wasn't a spider there, and it was a terrible experience. This went on for years. Well, hallucination. These people say that these men, like Peter and Paul and the rest, were suffering from an hallucination. They thought they saw a spirit body come in a room through a door that wasn't there, you know, the doors being shut, and they thought they handled this man, but they really didn't. See, he only appeared for 40 days. And they were deceived. And so they said that after the shock of the resurrection, their nerves were very overwrought, they were all upset and disturbed, and their very lives were in danger. And in this emotional disturbance, it was very likely that they had this hallucination and thought they saw somebody. Well now, if what kind of mind is it which, after an hallucination or one of these nightmares takes place, keeps on believing it? You know, my aunt, maybe it took her, as Paul says, 5 or 10 minutes to sort of gain her equilibrium, and then she'd know that there was no spider there and she'd be all right. But supposing you have somebody who keeps on seeing spiders crawling on their, you know, all the time. What kind of people are these?
Not deranged.
Yeah, they are people who are deranged, permanently deranged, and who usually are confined to an institution to care for them. It must be a very terrible experience. Now, turn to the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, because the Apostle Paul is one of these who are supposed to be in this condition. And read the 11th verse, Brother Cook. 1 Corinthians 15 and 11.
Therefore, whether it were I or they, so we preach and so we believe.
So we preach, he says. We are preaching the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So that 23 years after the Apostle Paul said that he had a vision of Jesus on their way to Damascus, he still believes it. In other words, he's still suffering from the same hallucination 23 years later. Right? According to this, because he says, we're still preaching it. So if you have somebody suffering from the same hallucination over a period of 23 years, they are hopelessly insane. Now let me ask you this. Is it likely that somebody whose mind is so deranged that he is still suffering from this terrible false vision, is it likely that he can write the lofty principles stated in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians? Can this go on in the same mind?
No.
No. It's psychologically impossible to have the same man suffer from a false hallucination over a period of 23 years and also in that same mind write the lofty principles that are contained in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. This is a psychological miracle greater than the miracle of raising Jesus.
That is one of the tests that they give to people that they suspect of mental problems, to checking the things they write and see what kind of sense they make and what sentences they
make. That's right. Give. Often the spoken word won't be too bad, but get them to write something and it's really rough.
Isn't it too a test of his sanity to be able to go out throughout the whole area around another grain and convince others? A deranged man,
yes,
was deranged, could not do that because he would be quickly recognized as deranged and he wouldn't get on with it. That's what I hear.
Well, the only trouble is that worries me about that argument is Mormonism. And this is a real difficulty on this point. The fact that they have been able to put that stuff forward is a phenomenon of this age, in my opinion. However, let's not get into Mormonism right now. Now, there's the Apostle Paul. Now, there's another catch to this business of hallucination, and that is that 500 people had the same hallucination. Now this is very, very unusual to have 500 people walking around all saying they had the same hallucination. Now my aunt had this spider about once a week coming down from the ceiling on her bed and was terribly disturbed. What would you think of the Farrer family if we all had that? You know, it would seriously erode your confidence in our mental processes, I think. Particularly if we kept on telling you every day we were excited about this spider. This was our whole life. The Farrer family couldn't shut up about it. That spiders are coming. Well, too bad. Well, here's 500 people who are dedicated and excited and who give their lives to telling you about this same hallucination. So this again is a psychological miracle. Now the Apostle Paul in verse 8 of the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and we'll ask Betty, will you read that? The 15th, yeah.
Yesterday he called, every day he called me to
mind. I meant Betty Hammond, but I don't care who reads it. I didn't even know they called you Betty earlier. So, all right. So he got this one vision of Jesus, right, on the way to Damascus. Did he claim that he kept on having these visions?
No.
No, he only claimed he had it once. And the 500 brethren didn't claim they kept on having these visions. They said he was there for 40 days and that ended it. So that we can say, I think, that it is psychologically impossible for 514 people to be all suffering from the same hallucination over a long period and not have them all completely out of their minds, which they obviously were not. Now there's another point that I think we should mention here, and that is that I'm going to talk for a minute now about Peter and Paul, because these two men were, I think, about as different as chalk and cheese. They were completely different temperaments entirely. One was a fisherman, the other was a lawyer, and by trade. And these two mentalities usually aren't the same. Now, let's look at 2 Corinthians 12 chapter. We're still discussing hallucinations and whether they were imagining these things or not. 2 Corinthians 12, 1 to 4. Andy, are you here? No. Oh, yeah, here he is. Fine. Okay.
2 Corinthians 12, 1 to 4?
Yeah.
I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago. Whether in the body, I cannot tell, or whether out of the body, I cannot tell. God knows. Such and one caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell. God knows. How that he was put up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which is not lawful from a man to utter.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. Was the Apostle Paul able to differentiate between visions and the real thing? According to these few verses, do you think? What do you think, Jim?
Well, it appears as though he was able to do so, but he let God do that.
Right, but he was able. I mean, he says here that he's discussing this vision where he was caught up. He's able to rationally discuss the matter as to whether or not it was or was not a vision or the real thing. Now, this is not, you can't dispassionately discuss hallucinations if you are the victim thereof. But Paul, obviously, was not a victim of hallucinations because he was able to rationally carry on a conversation with respect to it. Now, the same thing can be said of Peter. Now, if you'll turn back to Acts, the 10th chapter, and we'll refresh our mind briefly about the vision that Peter had. You remember that Peter, well, let's read the Acts 10 and 10. Brother Robinson, you got that?
10. And he became very humbled and would have eaten. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance.
Huh? Now, a trance is very similar to an hallucination. It's a mental aberration. Now, what was the trance, or what was what did he see in the trance? Remember?
Yeah,
sheet let down from heaven containing all kinds of clean and unclean creatures. Now, look at verse 17. Read that. Brother Boyle, have you got that? Will you read that, Brother Boyle?
Now when Peter bowed to himself on this vision which he appeared to me, behold, him with a different figure that made him twice the time of and stood in no day.
So here again, Peter was rationally discussing what the vision should mean. He was able to differentiate quite clearly between a vision and something real. Now, he notices here that this is a vision. He knew that there really wasn't a sheet descending down from heaven with these creatures in it. He saw a vision. He was in a trance, and he knew that. But when he was talking about the resurrection of Jesus, he said it was no vision, that he was an eyewitness of the fact that he had been raised from the dead. So this business of that these people were under a gigantic delusion and had a kind of saw Jesus in a trance, coming to him, it just doesn't stack up with the facts. Now, the 12th chapter of Acts, we have an even clearer picture, I think, of this. Herod had imprisoned Peter for preaching in the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And they locked him up in prison. Now, when you read the 8th and 9th verses of chapter 12, Owen.
And the angel said unto him, gird thyself, and bind on thy sandals. So he did. And he saith unto him, cast thy garment about thee, and follow me. And he went out and followed him, and wist not that it was true, which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision.
Now this is what Paul is talking about. He may have been asleep. I don't know whether it says that or not. Yes, I think it does. Because he, in verse 7, it says he raised him up quickly.
Peter was sleeping in the sixth.
Yeah, that's right. He was asleep. All right. Now, you can imagine you're asleep. And suddenly you're wakened up, and this would be just as new to Peter as it would be to you or to me. And they said, rise up quickly and get out of here. Chains fell off his hands, and they went out. So Peter wist not that it was true which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision. He was still probably half asleep, and he wasn't sure whether he was nightmaring this thing or whether it was real. Right? Now read the 11th verse. Sister Anderson? Now the point I want to make is when Peter had come to himself, what would we say probably in a synonym for that phrase? Yeah, when he woke up. When he finally got organized, came to and got oriented and shook the slumber off his mind and so on, when he really got fully awakened and found out what was going on, when he came to himself, when he came to his senses, when he was fully awake, then he knew that, and he says, now I know of a surety, you see. So from this, would you say that Peter was or was not a victim of unknown hallucinations? Why, certainly he recognized the difference. He was rationally able to recognize the difference between hallucinations and the real thing. Well, he said the real thing was that Jesus rose from the dead. This other thing, for a minute, he wasn't sure whether he was suffering from a nightmare or not, but finally he came to his senses and he knew it was real too. So that we can positively say, I think, that both Peter and Paul were quite able, from the record, to differentiate between imagination and the real thing. Now, there's an additional point with respect to Paul. Let's go back to the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians again that I think is important. And that is verses you are all familiar with. They're the 14th and 15th. Well, we'll read them anyway. Sister Moore, have you got them? So that the point I want to make here is that the Apostle Paul was able rationally to discuss the moral bearing of his testimony. He knew that if he was deceiving the people, that he had a tremendous moral responsibility toward them. So he said, if the resurrection of Jesus isn't true, we're deceiving you. And this is a great moral sin. And so a man suffering after 23 years from an hallucination is not able to coldly rationalize the moral concept of what he is doing. This is one thing that people confined to mental hospitals because of hallucinations are not able to do, is to differentiate the moral bearing of what they are saying. Now, it's quite clear from this excellent treatise that the Apostle Paul gave that he was suffering from no hallucination. So the whole warp and weft of this statement of the critics, that these 514 people were all suffering from the same hallucination, namely that Jesus really was raised from the dead, just doesn't hold water. Now, there is another point on this thing that I think is well worth noting. We said that Peter and Paul were as different as chalk and cheese. And we get funny fish in the net right here, too, in this day and age. Very different types come into the truth. People that are jealous of each other, people that don't get along too well, we get other types that get along just fine. But in the net, there are a lot of different types. Now, in this net in the first century, Peter and Paul were very different. Now, let's turn to Galatians 2. Now, I don't know whether Galatians, the second chapter, verse 11 to 14. I don't know whether you've ever had a controversy with a brother or not, but in this particular controversy, the Apostle Paul says that he found it necessary to withstand Peter to his face. Now, you know, it's one thing, and this is a very great follow on this, to need to get together with Herman and say, you know, brother, you know. Yeah, well, pretty bad. What he said was not so good, and how he acts is worse, and this and that. And we have a nice little cozy discussion about brother, you know. That's quite common. That's not so bad. But it's an entirely different thing to go to brother, you know, look him right in the eye and say, I have something against thee. And we're going to discuss this thing. I'm going to withstand you to your face on this matter. Now, I have a feeling that if this was done more often, or else silence were kept, that things would be a lot better. But anyway, this is what the Apostle Paul did. If he had a fault against a brother, he went to him and looked him right in the eye and said, now this is what we're going to discuss. So let's read it. When Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed. Here is the spokesman for the group, Peter, the man who Christ gave a commission to, the keys of the kingdom, if you please. And the Apostle Paul, who was a Johnny-come-lately, to use a slang phrase, has to take a hold of Peter and withstand him to the face. Now, let's see, this would be something like this. Let's have an instance where, don't forget that Paul was a member of the opposing party. He was just as foreign to the party of Peter as a Catholic priest was. In fact, he was an embryonic priest or a scribe lawyer of the opposing party. Now, can you imagine that, let's say that Brother Gehring, as an example, is widely known in the Christadelphian body. Let's say that a few years ago, a Catholic priest was converted, and he was sort of under suspicion. Nobody really knew quite whether he was or was not really in this thing. He did a lot of preaching, and he made a lot of converts, but he always had a kind of a question mark over him. This is what is the case of Peter and Paul. You know, when he came to Jerusalem, they weren't sure whether they should even receive him or not. Finally, they gave him the right hand of fellowship, this Catholic priest. And when he brought Timothy down, you know, there was another big rhubarb about circumcision and so forth. And there was always a question whether the Apostle Paul, and they always had a rifle out ready to shoot him down, as you know when you read the second chapter, second book of Corinthians, that he had either one or more brethren who were virtually sniping at him. Now, how would we all feel, or how would Brother Gehring feel, say, if this Johnny-come-lately Catholic priest withstood him to the face on something that he thought he was to be blamed about? Now, this is the background of this incident. Now, why did the Apostle Paul have to withstand Peter to his face? For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, If thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of the Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? Now this is pretty straight language, brothers and sisters. And there isn't one of us, I think, that wouldn't try and defend our position in this case. So here is a real uproar between the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter. Now, when you and I are in a conspiracy, and we have something that we know is a little phony, we can get along fine as long as we're getting along. But let some real intrusion come so that we're separated and pulled apart, then we start calling each other names. That's the first thing we start to do. And anything that one knows about the other, we start throwing it up. Now, there was a case something like this not long ago in the Chrysler Corporation. Chrysler Corporation was run by a man named Newberg. And Newberg had tremendous shares of stock in subsidiary suppliers, particularly suppliers, I think it was, of certain parts of the engine. Now, Newberg directed one of the chief engineers to write the specifications which Chrysler required so that only the subsidiary company in which he held stock could comply with the specifications. They'd send the specifications out all over as if it was a legitimate tender. But it so happened that the only firm who could really conform and still be cost-wise with the specifications that Chrysler required was this firm that Newberg had stock in. This was a neat deal. Now, the chief engineer of specifications knew that this was going on, and he was privy to it. So he went along with the gang. But the time came when Newberg went, or when this chief engineer went and wanted a raise and a new title and a new job, a grand promotion. Now, you know how internal corporation politics work. Newberg, the boss, said, no, we can't give you a raise and we can't give you a promotion. You're going to stay right there as chief of specifications. So the chief said, I am, eh? That's fine. It's great. So he just went to the board of directors and said, here's the whole story, man. This is what your president's doing. And Newberg was not only fired, but had to cough up $450,000 that he had made just in a very few months on this deal. Now, this is to show you how when birds of a feather can hang together up to a point, but let some controversy come in and the beans are spilled. Now, the Apostle Peter and Paul went forth throughout the Roman Empire to preach the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And they were both preaching the same thing, and all things were happy. They were getting along just fine. Now, if there had been a conspiracy, if they both really knew that what they were saying was false, that he never rose from the dead at all, that they thought he did, and that they knew the whole thing was a hoax, when something like this happens, and one brother stands up and before everybody and condemns the other brother for his action, then would not the beans have been spilled and the name-calling started if the whole thing was a hoax? Absolutely. They certainly would have spilled the beans. They would have said, well, now, just a minute. You're telling me about the dissembling of the Jews? I'll tell you something. The whole thing you're preaching about the resurrection of Jesus is a hoax. You and I both know it. How do you like that? And there were, the whole thing would have been washed out to sea. On a situation of this kind, you just couldn't have this kind of controversy taking place in the temper of two people like this, and have a secret thing that they both knew was false kept secret and said, no, especially when there was nothing to gain. They would have brought it out and said, the whole thing's a farce and we both know it. Now let's quit the nonsense and get rid of this thing. But the fact is that during this dissimulation, they both kept on preaching the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Now this is no mean thing to have in the scriptures here as a psychological buttress and fortress against which we can check the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Have I made my point on that?
Yeah, I think the point's very good. What was people you telling us to say, well, this is all right if you believe what it says that in the book you're reading there?
Well, then I hand them blunt.
I didn't get what
happened. Well, this is all right if you believe Galatians and Acts and Corinthians is all right.
Well, look, we have to come at this thing from all spokes of the wheel, to use a terminology of one of the other teachers on these points. And this particular point is one of internal evidence. External evidence, I think, is what we talked about yesterday, where the fact is that Christianity is here. Now, how to get here and under what circumstances? This is a point of internal evidence, and I now propose to deal with another point of internal evidence. For the balance of this class.
Just one point. In 2 Peter 3, verse 15, which is after this happened, Peter is writing about the work of the Apostle Paul, and he says, "And accounts of the long suffering of our Lord is salvation, who is given unto him, hath risen unto you." So he certainly didn't do anything to fracture their relationship.
Right. Which shows a tremendous spiritual mindedness on the part of Peter. Not too many people would take that.
I think comments. Analogy, Brother
Fitzgerald
would
say the same thing. Yes, I think Brother Jim would. Sure, he would.
I think Peter, on one occasion, said that Paul wrote things which were hard to be understood by another person, didn't he?
Yes.
But he didn't controvert. He said that he had written something hard to be understood. I don't think he would try to withstand him on
it. Has, I think, a tremendous little sagacity to it. It was developed again by Dr. Fun, kind of a renegade one, I guess he was, but he developed this little nut that I'm now going to give you, and I think it's really good. Weather had come from the grave, but he really didn't. The idea is, you see, that the disciples had an affinity for Jesus. You know, they were on his side, rising the dead, and they didn't want to prove him a liar. So they, in their benevolence toward him, and their affinity toward him, and their love toward him, they wanted to carry on the thought, you know, that he rose from the dead. And so after his death, they thought, well, he said this and that, and we'll carry on the thought and go forth and tell people that he rose all right. They sort of imagined it and sort of worked it up in their own mind, and they went forth to proclaim this supposed truth. This is what higher German critics have to say on this point. All right, let's look at the thing. Is the position of one was that? Who was on the team that was a cult? So anything you have to say about all this great benevolence and they had these wonderful lofty thoughts toward Jesus didn't apply to Judas. They have applied to John and all these other, but it did not apply to Judas. Now let's just see the position of Judas. Now turn with me to the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, because we have to get a little background here again. And I haven't left myself enough time to really develop this. I'm sorry. So if you'll pardon me, I'll maybe read some of this myself, although I like members of the class to do the reading. But in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, at verse 15, here is one of the principal prophecies of Messiah. We talked about this the first lesson. The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren, like unto me, and unto him shall ye hearken. Now in verse 18, again, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee. Now notice what this prophet was going to, the attributes this prophet was going to have. He was going to be like unto Moses, number one. Number two, what words were going to be in his mouth? The words of God. Very important, this Messiah. He shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. That's God. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. Now, the Moses gives a test. Herman was talking, or often does talk, about a chemical test, how you test. A litmus paper is a simple test. You put it in, if it turns red, it's one thing. If it turns blue, it's another. Now, the test was, well, let's read what the test was about this prophet who was to come, whether they could recognize him or not. There was a test. But the prophet which shall presume to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or that shall speak in the name of other gods, even that prophet shall die. So what was the divine sentence for a false Messiah who came saying he was the prophet like unto Moses, but who was not?
Yeah.
So the law itself gave license, and even, if you please, commandment, that any man who came saying he was Messiah, the one like unto Moses, and who was not, who wasn't speaking the words that were put in his mouth of the Lord, that prophet shall die. They had legal right to put him to death. Now, here's the test. If thou shalt say in thine heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord hath not spoken? How do we know whether this man is going to be the Messiah or not? Remember, they said, all men used in their hearts, art thou that prophet? How do we know whether it's real or false? All right. How do we know? When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken. In other words, if he prophesied and the thing didn't come to pass, or if he was not able to show by his words which was proceeded out of his mouth that he was not speaking in the name of the Lord, then he was a false prophet. But the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously, thou shalt not be afraid of him. So the test was that if the thing followed not, nor came to pass, he wasn't able to produce the attributes of Moses, then he was a false prophet, and the thing to do was to put him to death. He was a deceiver. Now, one of the attributes that Moses had, given by God, is stated in Deuteronomy 34. Verses 10 and 11. Blair, will you read those?
And there arose not a prophet fit in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, and all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, and to all his servants, and to all his land. And in all that mighty land, and in all the great terror which Moses showed in the sight of all Israel.
Now, throughout the scriptures, both here and in many parts of the Old Testament and in many parts of the New, particularly in the book of Acts, there are three words which were the sign, and they are signs, wonders, and miracles. These were the signs of the true prophet, if he were able to do miracles and wonders and signs. Now, did Moses do miracles and wonders and signs?
Yes.
Name one that he did. One, just one. Plagues of Egypt, making the water stream out of the rock, the turning of the serpent into a rod and the reverse and so on. Miracles, wonders, and signs. The things came to pass at the mouth of the Lord. These were the hallmark of the prophet like unto Moses. Now, the Jews, therefore, believed in miracles, wonders, and signs from the Old Testament. They were well aware that their prophets, Elijah raised the dead, so forth, were able to do miracles and wonders and signs. So, Did they expect the Messiah, when he came, to be able to perform miracles and wonders and signs?
Yes.
Of course they did. And would they receive a Messiah who was unable to do miracles and wonders and signs?
No.
No. So they were in expectation that when Messiah came, he would be able to do miracles and wonders and signs. That was the hallmark of whether he was or was not the Messiah. So when John was in prison, he sent word through his disciples to Jesus and said, "Art thou he that should come, or look we for another?" Did Jesus send back a message saying, "Now go and tell John, yeah, I am the Messiah"? No. What did he do? How did he tell John that he was the Messiah? He went and told John, he said, "Go and tell John that the dead are raised, that the blind are healed, that the lame are able to walk, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Go and tell them that." Now, when they told John that, did he know that he was the Messiah? Yes, because he was able to do these miracles and wonders and signs. Now, another thing. Jesus, my goodness, I should have left more time for this. Jesus used miracles as his proof of Messiahship. Remember, he says, "If you don't believe what I say, at least believe me for the very works' sake." He used miracles as proof of his Messiahship. Now, we are told by the critics that these poor fishermen and tax collectors and so on were so carried away by their enthusiasm for Jesus that they sort of thought he was raised from the dead, but he really wasn't. Now let's consider this man Judas for a minute. Maybe the others were carried away. Maybe they did have some halo of enthusiasm for Jesus. But you can't say that about Judas. He was not carried away. He was a cold, calculating, mathematical miser. He wanted to get what was in it for Judas, never mind anything else. Now let me ask you this. How long was Judas with Jesus?
3.5 years.
Right. Did Judas know in here whether Jesus did or did not perform miracles and wonders and signs?
Yeah.
Certainly he knew. He knew exactly whether he performed those things or not. Now, if Judas was doing what we read about in the book of Deuteronomy, and if Jesus was the false Messiah, and what he said about being raised from the dead was false, what he said about all these other things was false, what was Judas's duty as a Jew?
To see that he was put to death.
Because if anybody in this world knew the real facts of whether or not Jesus was or was not the true Messiah, it was Judas. And if he wasn't the real Messiah, Judas would have perfect knowledge thereof, and it was his duty to go to the high priest and tell him, "I happen to know, I've been with him for 3.5 years, and this man is false. He really is not the Messiah, and therefore, according to our own law, he should be put to death." Now, read John 17 and, pardon me, read John 19 and 7 for this very point. Here's Jesus standing before Pilate, and the Jews are accusing him, and in the 7th verse it says, "The Jews answered Pilate, 'We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. He said he was the Messiah, and he isn't, and therefore by our law," which we read in the book of Deuteronomy, "he ought to die." That's our bounden duty, to kill him. All right, now let's see how Judas, the man with perfect knowledge of the true facts of Jesus' work, how he reacted to this thing. Matthew, the 26th chapter. Verse 14. Matthew 26 and 14. "Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, 'What will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you?' And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And from that time he sought opportunity to betray him." So for 30 pieces of silver, Judas made a covenant, a contract with the high priest to deliver him over to them. Now the plan of the high priest was to take him sort of away from the multitude when there wouldn't be any uproar. Now Judas also had knowledge not only of his messiahship, but of some other priceless ingredient of information. And that tidbit of information was that Judas knew when Jesus knew when his hour was come. You see, they went to make, one time they tried to make him a king by force. He said he just went through their way. His hour was not yet come. But there came a time, and Judas knew very well what it was, and Jesus told them, because he mentioned that he said, now we go to Jerusalem when the Son of Man must be crucified. Judas knew when that hour was up. So when he knew that Jesus was now ready to be sacrificed, then was the psychological time. He went to the high priest and said, he's ready, and you give me the money, and I'll tip you off on the exact time and place. So Judas had these two priceless ingredients of information which were denied to anybody else. Now, so he did. He did betray him, and they gave him the money, and they went out and arrested him. Now, everybody wants to justify their action. If I tell a brother off, I want to justify it. Whatever I do, I want to be right. You know that. And so do you. Now at this trial, they were seeking for witnesses. They had Jesus up before Pilate and up before the Sanhedrin, and they sought witnesses to condemn him to death. Now who would have been the star witness under the law to condemn this man to death? Judas would have been a perfect witness, because he could have been put on the stand and said, now, you have perfect knowledge that this man says he's the Son of God and says he's the Messiah, but he really isn't. Judas would have been a tremendous witness. He could have wrapped up the whole case in 5 minutes. They could have put him to death quite legally. In fact, it would have been their duty to do so. So Judas would have been a tremendously great witness to show the falsity of Jesus' messiahship, that the whole thing was one gigantic hoax. Did Judas take the stand?
No.
Judas took no stand. Now turn to the 27th chapter of Matthew. And verse 1 says, when the morning was come, the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. They were marshaling all their forces to get this man out of the way. Any witness at all, any excuse at all, was capital for them. Well, what happened? In verse 3, then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. Now, what did he say? And where did he say it? Judas, the man with perfect knowledge, said, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, the very castle of the high priest. This was the testimony of the man who had perfect knowledge. Now the very fact that he went out and did what? Committed suicide is a roaring testimony of the truth of the messiahship and the resurrection of Jesus. If Jesus had been an imposter, Judas would have been no suicide.